We are going to this rate regulation.
Thank you very much, Hans. Good afternoon. We have three papers to discuss with you today. This should be our last papers to present to you, unless we identify any good issues while we're drafting the exposure draft. The first of the papers, 9A, deals with assessment about the regulatory agreement boundary, and this is a paper that we're bringing back to you as you requested it in July 2019. The second of the paper is 9B, and this paper analyzes the need for further amendments to IFRS standards or the need to develop clarifications on the interactions between the model and the IFRS standards. And this paper is also an analysis that complements the discussions we had with the board in November 2018. And lastly, the third of the papers that we will discuss today with you is 9C, and this paper recommends transition provisions for the model. Another point that I'd like to make before we start the presentation of the papers is that we have revisited the expected publication date of the exposure draft, and this will now be Q2 2020. So with that, then, I think we can start. If you don't have any other questions, we can start with paper 9A, which is the further analysis on the regulatory agreement boundary.
Thanks, Mariella. As Mariella mentioned, this was a topic we first discussed at the July 2019 meeting, where staff presented a paper on how an entity would determine the regulatory agreement boundary. The regulatory agreement boundary represents the point at which the agreement would no longer confer enforceable rights or obligations to the entity. Regulatory assets and liabilities are those rights and obligations to add or deduct an amount from the rates, and this would only be prior to the boundary. However, the discussion in July 2019 identified this as an area which could be challenging for entities, and thus you requested we carry out further analysis which would form the basis for application guidance to be provided with the model, and this paper attempts to set out that analysis. The first section of the paper in paragraphs 11 through 39 set out our analysis of the factors an entity would consider in establishing the boundary. One of these factors that we anticipate to be the most complex would be the analysis of options to cancel or extend the agreement. In respect of the analysis of these options, staff have made a recommendation in paragraph 18 of the paper that an entity should consider only those options that the holder has the practical ability to exercise, and that it should not consider the likelihood of exercise or either party's intentions in making its assessment. So I'd like to pause there to ask the first question in the paper on whether the board concurs with this recommendation.
Tom.
Just a quick question. Just on paragraph 13, just so I'm clear, it talks about terms and clauses and then says we anticipate that the analysis of these options. So the options referred to is sort of a broad set, and they can be implicit and explicit.
Correct. I think by options we mean clauses that could impact the duration of the regulatory agreement.
Jen Chow.
Yes. I generally agree with staff's recommendation, especially paragraph 18A, that is focused on whether the holder of the option have, you know, practical ability to exercise the option. It's no problem. I think it's the right way to address it. I have a little bit of concern about 18B, that is the entity should not consider the likelihood of exercise of the option or either the party's intention. I think that because paragraph 18A said that the entity should consider all options that could affect the boundary. It could mean, I think, there's always some kind of judgment involved, some kind of uncertainty should be considered. It's relevant to the likelihood. And secondly, when I read the paragraph 22, paragraph 22 mentions some real cases. also mentioned that whether when the company or regulator has an option, and whether that option have an impact on the regulatory agreement boundary, and what kind of circumstances in which you decide whether the party has, you know, practical ability to exercise that option. But in that paragraph, actually, when we went through the analysis, actually we considered the likelihood, and then we addressed the so-called recognition threshold of more likely than not. So it seemed that this kind of likelihood at certain stage actually considered involving the whole judgment when they should be recognized or not. So I'm a little bit concerned about the paragraph 18b, that criteria, whether we do need or not. From my point of view, I think the notion of practical ability, I think it's general principle. I think it's enough to build the regulatory agreement boundary criteria.
Okay. Yeah, no, thanks. Thanks for that comment. Paragraph 22, we were trying to cover off the rarer cases where the regulatory agreement may not be clear enough to make an assessment on the practical ability. So we don't expect that to be encountered frequently by entities in making their assessment. The purpose of paragraph 18B was to address some of the confusion that arose in the discussion at the previous board meeting. And we've said all the way along that a binding regulatory agreement is necessary to support the recognition of these rights and obligations as regulatory assets and regulatory liabilities. And we feel that binding nature should not be subject to an assessment that's based on likelihood. It should be subject to an assessment that's based on the practical ability of either party to exercise one of these options. So I think we agree that the principle is this practical ability, but we are trying to underline the fact that is more of a binary, a factual assessment that is not contingent on the likelihood of the exercise of an option or the intention of either party to exercise an option.
I agree with what you are recommending in paragraph 18, but I just want to make sure that we're agreeing with the same, that my understanding of what you're proposing is what I'm agreeing with. My understanding is that this first question is really just saying that the options that you should consider when you're working out what is in the boundary include everything except those where there's no practical ability to exercise in any circumstances. So in the first instance, you're just sort of excluding the ones that, you know, nobody can ever anticipate would be exercised. And then the paper later on goes on to then give a more nuanced assessment of then how you think about those options and which ones matter to the boundary. Yeah. And my understanding of 18B is it's a subtle point, and I think it's a confusing point, not because of what you've written here. I just think it's hard to express, and it was hard in the framework, and it's hard again here. And this is just saying that, trying to confirm, I think, make sure my understanding is correct, that what we're focusing on here is whether the options are really giving rise to rights and obligations. And if you have a right, it doesn't matter whether or not we expect that you're going to exercise it. The question is there a right?
Yes.
And that's a distinction. That's all you're trying to distinguish, yeah?
It's an existence point, not a...
Yeah, likelihood of exercise.
Point. Yeah.
Adele?
It's actually, I have just thinking about that the references to the framework are strong in relation to rule out likelihood for liabilities. I just work a bit more to rule out the likelihood for assets as well, because at least when we look at the paragraph 16 and 17, especially the 17, it rules out likelihood for liability, but doesn't for asset.
Okay, can we agree with the staff's recommendation?
14.
The remainder of this section goes on to discuss other factors that an entity would consider in determining the boundary. So paragraphs 19 through 39 provide a description of some of these additional factors, and paragraphs 40 through 43 set out the implications of determining the boundary on the accounting requirements of the model. And lastly, paragraphs 44 through 48 compare the guidance recommended in this paper for the determination of the boundary to the requirements of other standards in similar situations. And at the end of this section, we have a question for the board on our recommendation regarding the inclusion of application guidance in the proposed new standard of the factors an entity considers in determining the regulatory agreement boundary.
Mary.
I have three comments about, well, I had three comments about the analysis in this section, and then Jing Zhao's question on paragraph 22 maybe raises a fourth. The first is about the practical ability to avoid that you discuss in paragraph 20. I'm on board with the notion that of looking to the concept of no practical ability to avoid, but I think it's very important that we set it at a level that is, you know, what we consider to be no practical ability to avoid, really consistent with what's in the conceptual framework. And to me, when you get to C, I think you can't avoid it absent liquidation isn't an EG. It is, to me, almost the definition of when you don't have practical ability. And what I'm worried about, thinking about the subject we were discussing just before lunch and our FICE project, is, you know, we've had endless issues in FICE with economic compulsion. And, you know, economic compulsion is a reason why something might become more and more and more likely that you will act in a certain way. And people talk about economic compulsion, meaning you have no practical ability to avoid. But I think, you know, and I'm kind of looking in Peter's direction when we talk in the conceptual framework about no practical ability to avoid, we're really talking about the only way you could avoid it is liquidation. So I think I would draw the discussion of this in a narrower fashion rather than a broad fashion, because right now it implied that, well, the extreme case is liquidation, but there may be other instances. And while there may be, I think I'd be very careful with the tone, or we're going to find ourselves pursuing all the many rabbit holes of economic compulsion. So that was one. A second is on paragraph 31, we've gotten into the area in which the regulatory agreement says if you lose or decide not to renew an agreement, you will be made whole for certain balances that you have not been able to bill. And I think it's right to think about your right to bring up this issue of make whole arrangements and how it factors in. But first of all, you may want to think about making a cleaner cut between just having a discussion of what is the boundary, and you're starting to veer in a couple of places here into measurement, you know, of things when you're in the boundary. And I think it may be better to have a cleaner distinction between the two. Because I having raised measurement here, I'll comment about the measurement, but I think that the core issue is what's the boundary. If the only right you have beyond 2027 is to be made whole, then I don't see why the difference, if there is any, between what your right to bill is and the amount that you would be paid under made whole is a measurement issue. The only right that you have after 2027 is to be made whole. So I don't see why we're factoring in made whole and what you would bill is kind of getting to the probability that, you know, you will extend beyond 2027, which is, so A, I say strike measurement from the discussion of boundary, and then when you do get to measurement, think about whether it's consistent with exercise or not. The third thing I think you should do X, but I scratched my head and couldn't quite get there, in paragraph 38, you're talking about other things that may identify when you have a boundary that is further out than the stated agreement date. And I read paragraph 38 as saying, well, if I have decided that I have a provision, and let me say it's for decommissioning or for pension costs, you know, something that is way off in the distance beyond the 2027 end of my agreement, but I read paragraph 38 as saying the fact that you record that obligation implies that there is a boundary that is later than 2027. And I don't see how me recognizing what is my obligation extends my rights beyond 2027. I mean, I think in some rate-regulated activities, there's a possibility that if after 2027 you are no longer the operator, that you may transfer that obligation to whoever succeeds you. I don't think it's automatic, but that, you know, I think that comes more into the question of, do you have an obligation? Do you have a contingent obligation? I'm not trying to suggest you shouldn't be recognizing it, but I think the transfer is one thing. But I just don't get the basis of saying, I mean, I may be misreading paragraph 38, but my understanding was that you factor in the duration of obligations that you've recognized into determining what your boundary is. And then I'll just throw in the fourth thing and then turn it back to you, which is Jean Zhao's paragraph about 22. Again, I know you've labeled it in rare cases, and if it's really expected to be rare cases, I'd strongly encourage not discussing this issue, because again, it starts to feel very much like what you're trying to assess is the probability that you'll be, you know, still operating in that period, rather than saying you know, I think you've made it clear that you have to consider explicit and implicit options. And the case when it's not clear may be an implicit option. And what you're trying to do is decide what the boundary is. And while I can understand why we'd reach for something like more likely than not, that more likely than not criterion was developed in the context of saying you're inside the regulatory agreement. There may be some uncertainty about whether a certain cost for an activity is allowed. You have to make a determination on the basis of your understanding of the agreement. So it's taking something from another purpose and applying it here. It's good if, you know, we apply consistent thresholds, but I think we're maybe overcomplicating it. So my encouragement would just be to delete this discussion.
Okay.
Anne?
In relation to paragraph 49, which is your recommendation that we're talking about, I think the first three things you mention are qualitatively different from the fourth thing. So if I was an entity and I was applying this recommendation, which will be in application guidance, there are three things I can look at: existing term, options impacting, make-whole mechanisms. And then number four is something different again. So as it's stated here, when I first read it, I wasn't sure when it was consistency with judgments made in other IFRS. I mean, whose judgments are they? Are they the entity's judgments in applying those, or are they the board's thinking? And I think it's the latter. I think it's the board's thinking within those standards provides some sort of guidance. And I think it's relevant. I think the guidance is relevant, but I think you have to handle it differently. I don't think it can be tacked on as number four in that little list. I think you have a list of three, and I think that there is something there that's encompassed in four, but I think it needs a separate presentation or consideration and has to be abundantly clear what it is we think, where the guidance lies. I think what you're saying here is that the guidance lies in the decisions that have been made within those standards, and so therefore there's a principle there being applied. So it's that little principle that's embedded in the standard that you then want entities to bring across and apply here.
That may relate to my paragraph 38 question.
But the intention with the fourth point was actually the consistency with the judgments the entity has made in applying other standards. So related to Mary's comment on the provisions.
Okay.
I understand it could be confusing because we had both consistency with its own judgments applying the standards, and then we did the analysis comparing to IFRS 17 and 10, and that's all preceding this recommendation. So.
Okay, that's totally fine. It's still of a nature, a different sort of thing when you say factors are. So I think you need to identify it as something separate in the guidance.
Yep. Okay. Thanks.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I had the same issues that Mary, so I'm not going to repeat them. I agree with the various items that she has raised. I have an additional point, or maybe 2 points to make. I'm concerned, and maybe not rightly so, but I would, you know, in paragraph 20A, you refer to entities that have a monopoly, and as a result would be difficult to replace. And I wouldn't want our guidance to be read as suggesting that just because you are in such a circumstance, basically, should you look at the boundary as being indefinite. So I think in the way we write guidance, I think we should put on this issue a focus on how long does it take for the regulator to select a different operator, and that the factor is in fact your estimate of the length of time given the circumstances, but so that you do not we do not in the guidance project the idea that it could be indefinite, unless of course I mean that would be the case, but we're not talking about this here. About paragraph 22, so I said I agreed with Mary. Maybe not, however, to come to the conclusion that we should ignore that it may happen. Where I agree is that I wouldn't be comfortable at all with the more likely than not. In fact, that's what I said last time. You know, to me, exactly as Mary said, the boundary is one thing, and within that boundary, the way you recognize various timing difference effects of that various timing difference is another. So, to me, the recognition criterion was for these individual items within the binding agreement. Mm-hmm. So, I can relate to the concern that it would be disruptive to have stop and go accounting for this kind of items just because you don't know. But I think if we don't know, it's better to attract the user attention that we don't know, rather than do as if it didn't matter whether we know or not, especially because here we're talking about the supplementary elements that we assets and liabilities that we have to account for eventually. But I think if there is an uncertainty about the future of that regulatory agreement, I think there are many more stakes than just those assets and liabilities. So it, that also concurs to me to say, well, make it apparent.
Gary?
Thank you. And, Neil, I'm sort of hitting in the same space as the last three or four board members asked, but I just want to make sure I understand what I think you're saying. But if I went to paragraph 39, the top of page 12, and as I talk about a major plant that has a useful life of 20 years, I'm thinking big utilities, whether it's a power plant, a hydroelectric dam, you're talking billions of dollars perhaps, and maybe 100 years life in some cases. But sticking with the life of 20 years, I go to the next sentence down and says, but the boundary is only 3 years. So what do I do? I don't think you're saying amortize it over 3 years. If you have a make-whole agreement, I understand that, you know, that they protect you because you wouldn't invest, you know, that much money unless you knew how you were going to, at least some way you would get it back. But is that where, gee, could last 20 years, the boundaries three, where I start looking to more likely than not, or what do I do? I mean, it's not clear to me in this paper what you would do.
Yeah, no, we're just trying to illustrate the fact that if you did reach that differing conclusion, so a useful life of 20 years, and your initial assessment was that the regulatory boundary might occur in 3 years, to go back and revisit that assessment of the boundary. We're not directing into a probability or likelihood-focused assessment at that stage. We're just saying, as you mentioned, you may have invested a significant amount in that asset, and you might have done so with some sort of assurance that you were going to be able to operate for the next 20 years. So consider what that assurance was, whether it was a make-whole revision or something to do with one of the options surrounding the length of the agreement, and ensure you're factoring that in appropriately when you're determining the boundary.
Yeah, I'm not sure that directly answers. Right. Let's say you didn't have a make-whole agreement, but the regulators, as long as you sort of hit your performance metrics, you're almost certain the regulator is just going to continue to renew. I mean, would you consider that? And that seems like a more likely than not scenario. If I do what I'm supposed to do, they'll just let me keep doing it, and they'll just keep renewing or extending the regulatory agreement. Is that a way to think about it?
We want to avoid that probability kind of based assessment, because we're talking about incremental rights or obligations to add.
How would you do that if you can't look at probability?
So, for example, if I understand Gary's question correctly, let's say, and I don't know, you might tell me this just doesn't happen, but it might help. If we've entered into this arrangement and there is no formal extension option in the agreement per se, mm-hmm. So you don't have, you know, as a formal written option to assess, if you like, but there's a regulatory environment and the expectation perhaps of the parties, when, to Gary's point, they invested billions in this piece of infrastructure, was that this will be an arrangement that goes for some period of time, but there isn't actually a contract with a formal extension option. Mm. We are saying that they need to make an assessment of the whether there's really a practical ability for the regulator to walk away from this arrangement, given this piece of infrastructure, despite the fact there's not a formal renewal clause. So it's not likelihood per se, but you're saying, is there really a practical ability for the regulator to walk away? So is that the expectation? I think that's what Gary's asking.
I mean, I think the main reason this example is in is because of a question that came up last time, which is, if the boundary of the contract is 3 years and the useful life of the asset is 20 years, does that mean that the boundary of 3 years puts a sort of upper limit on the useful life of the asset? And our answer is no, because you're really answering different questions. But for the boundary of the asset, you're looking at how far out do the binding rights and obligations go. For the useful life of the asset, you're looking at how long can it be used for. That's not dependent just on binding rights and obligations. So that was the main point we were trying to make, really, with this example. The point about the practical ability that's in B is a kind of secondary point in a way, which is whatever judgments you made in assessing the useful life of the fixed assets might have some bearing on your assessment of the regulatory boundary. I don't think we're trying to make a big deal of that. We were just saying,
I'm trying to think about my regulatory asset, because I'm sort of asking a simpler question. Mm-hmm. So if I'm trying to look at my regulatory asset, which we're asking people to account for, and trying to work out whether or not it's appropriate to look beyond the 3 years and to look at the expectation of recovery beyond 3 years, what do I do there? Is that where this practical ability assessment comes in?
It gives you a data point to think about in that assessment, and it may or may not be a very significant data point.
I don't know, it seemed to me like it'd be a very significant. If you don't have a make-whole agreement, and I'm just putting that aside, and maybe that's so infrequent that you wouldn't with capital spending like that, you know, but you posited it as a possibility here. So I'm just trying to close it off, or at least understand it. I mean, I don't see any place where you would, let's say the 20 years versus three, you know, I mean, the question is, I only have practical use. Ability to use for 3 years. Do I have an impairment charge for 17 years worth? I don't think that's where you're going with this.
I think one of the things, and I think you raised it last time, Gary, as well in this, is that, you know, the environment that we're in, the regulator, the regulator in this environment has a commitment to make sure that these services continue to be supplied. So we're not looking at time periods of 3 years. If there's a boundary to this regulatory agreement of 3 years, something has to happen at the end of that 3 years to make sure somebody is continuing the supply.
And you're looking at the probability of the more likely than not that they're going to extend or renew or whatever, go through the normal process.
I think it goes to Sue's point about practical ability. If we've got the supplier that's got this massive infrastructure asset in place, how are you going to find an alternative supplier that's got the same infrastructure that can then replace what
they'd have to make whole you when they'd have to buy out your asset and give it, you know, ultimately all utilities. They've got a neighbor, you know, next to them that's a different utility, and they, you know, can theory poach, you know, I'll take your territory, you know, I mean, I'll take your plant, but you got to pay for it.
And I think that's the point, is the practical ability. You can't just walk in and take somebody else's plant. There has to be a mechanism in order to.
But I agree, practical ability to avoid is a factor, just like more likely than not is a factor, and you seem to be not dismissing them, but minimizing them, I think, are extremely important.
Daryl?
Can I just clarify my understanding then of where this has got to? Because I'm not too sure. The problem is there's a whole bunch of different moving parts. So I have, let's say in this example, an underlying asset, and I have determined what I believe is the appropriate period of depreciation for that asset based on the various ways that I valued it. Then I come to look at the boundary, and I guess in the circumstance we're talking about, I'm presumably not just recovering the use of the asset on a period-by-period basis. There's some kind of back-ended recovery. So I'm using more of the asset now than I'm actually recovering, and so I want to recognize beyond my binding period. But the scenario we've got here is I'm clearly in a binding relationship for 3 years, even though I've got an underlying 20-year asset. At the outset, if that's all I've got, then I would only recognize a regulatory asset to the extent of the 3 years' worth of cash flows. I wouldn't recognize anything beyond that timetable. But this is also encouraging me to say, why did I think I could depreciate the asset over 20 years? And to just revisit that thinking and then say, well, would I really have gone into a 20-year asset if I only thought I was going to get 3 years' life out of it? Something else has fed my thought process, and B is just a reminder to think about that something else. But it's definitely not telling me that I have to recognize the regulatory asset beyond the three-year horizon, even if I have concluded that I'm going to depreciate the asset over 20
years. But what that says is... practical ability question.
Yeah. Exactly. It's that. So, I mean, there's a couple of things that affect practical ability. This is, B is encouraging me to think about practical ability. Now, it could be that there is nothing that says somebody can't step into that space, but it seems like something has informed my decision to purchase or to invest in that underlying asset, and that may well be that I thought that there was no practical ability for the contract to have, for the regulatory agreement to, in fact, end after 3 years.
But the question we were trying to answer was really more about A than B.
Yes.
B's more a kind of afterthought. Yeah. The main point here was A.
Yeah, and I'm okay, perfectly.
About the depreciation.
If you can use judgment, whether based on practical ability, a more likely than not, a more likely than perhaps just the regulator's got a 100-year history of just routinely extending these things as long as you're performing satisfactorily, I'm okay on all that. I just don't know that these words get you there so as cleanly or as... quickly as you might. I mean, because still keep going back to the regulatory boundary. And my the regulatory boundary is there's a legal boundary, then there's a practical boundary that's a lot longer. You know, again, if a make-whole agreement solves the problem, but I don't know how common they are or not.
Mary?
Just two observations from this discussion. I think we're illustrating that the road to hell is paved with good intentions. Because I think what this discussion has shown us is, let's focus only on the single issue of what is the boundary. And as much as we're trying to be helpful and point out the, don't forget to think about depreciable life, don't forget to think about this, it tangles too many things together. Let's just stick to one. And the other is, to the extent that things are identified as factors to be considered, discuss them, but don't discuss them in a way that says, and then this is the outcome. because I think what we'll be doing is setting examples where people say, as long as I meet this fact pattern, this tells me I have X boundary. So I think we have to be very careful about how much analysis and conclusion is there, as opposed to just pointing out why a factor may be relevant to the determination of boundary.
If I understood well, I mean, what has been going on, I think what eventually can be misinterpreted in what you suggest is the fact that the other judgments that you would have made would be a factor in order to assess the boundary. And I think that's where it gets messed up. So it's completely different, in my view, to say you have these different factors to consider before you make your judgment as to what the boundary is, and then say, make sure that the various judgments that you've made across your accounting altogether are consistent, well-documented, and justifiable. But that does not make a prior judgment or a parallel judgment a factor in itself. It's not something that you're going to take into account to reach a conclusion. It's going to be something eventually that you question, that you challenge, or challenge your outcome in this particular instance, but not a factor.
Okay,
let's come to a vote. Is there any need to reformulate the recommendation? Or?
I think so.
We were just presenting here a series of factors to consider. And then, yes, we have received many comments that might influence the way we would need to draft the corresponding application guidance. But at a high level, do you think then those factors are reasonable and we should then consider them when determining the regulatory agreement boundary?
Okay.
I think I'd like to take out the reference to consistency with judgments at this stage, because I think we've had a lot of comments that say it might be confusing. I think at least we've maybe given it more emphasis than we intended. And I think it might be better not to have it sort of written up in the decision at this stage. We can think a bit about it a bit as we do the drafting. But.
Yeah, I also agree with Peter. Actually, I also mentioned, I think we should... separate, if we need to consider separately with regard to consistent with other standards, I think it's different. We just focus on how to apply the practical ability to this standard, to this project. I think it's okay. You're not too confusing with other standards. I agree.
And can we vote on the assumption that the more likely than not assessment of the boundary goes away? In case
paragraph
of existence
22.
Uncertainty.
Huh? The paragraph 22.
I mean, not that it disappears totally, but the outcome, the potential outcome, is eliminated.
Well, perhaps we can leave something to the drafting.
It's substantive.
Yeah, I know. Well, are we going to do the whole discussion again, or...? Does the staff understand?
Yeah, so for that one, I'll tell you what my reaction is, which I don't think we've written up. We've got in the written decision at the moment, so I would have said look at that one in drafting. My leaning, having heard the discussion, would be to delete paragraph 22.
Okay, with that amendment, can we support the staff's recommendation?
Subject to.
That's with Peter's striking of the consistency.
So that's deleting the reference to the significant judgments and also the expecting that we delete 22 in the drafting, I think.
Okay, and that takes us to the last section of that paper, which just discusses how, or the staff's recommendation for how an entity would account for and disclose a change in the regulatory agreement boundary. And so we have a question for the board in paragraph 55. Just ask whether the board concurs with that recommendation.
Nick?
I just worry that, you know, we're in an incremental model here. Are we just getting too granular with this information? That's what concerns me. If I look at the example in paragraph 55, I'm not sure. hopefully the language, perhaps by company, be expressed differently. I'm not sure what a user would think of that language there and know what to do with it. So I feel it's just too granular, given that we are in an incremental model already. So I wouldn't have it.
Tom?
Okay. If you're following up, I'd rather wait.
Well, go ahead, Tom.
Oh, okay. Well, I guess I don't want to break the flow. Like, I'll actually wait.
Okay, well. Don't let
him back in. If Hans lets you back in.
Yeah.
Amble, Tom.
Tom Smiley.
Well, I mean, I think materiality should play here its role. So I think, if materiality, of course, there is materiality, I think it should be useful to identify what you have that should be identified.
No. Mary?
I think Francois and I are on the same wavelength very much today.
Okay. Because
I supported the staff position. I think it's consistent with the conceptual framework and the second alternative. I mostly just had a small question. Are you intending any disclosures at the end of X1? Because they've got something that's it's a non-zero probability it will show up in this case.
I think we did have to go back and check the presentation in July, though. I think we said that if you had an amount that fell outside the boundary and it was material, that you would consider disclosure to meet some of our other disclosure objectives, yes.
Okay, can we support the staff's recommendation? Then we go to paper 9B.
In paper 9B, we present our analysis of the potential amendments required to other IFRS standards as a result of the rate-regulated project, and also our recommendations on any application guidance on the application of the model alongside the requirements of other IFRS standards. So staff have not identified any new amendments necessary to the requirements of other IFRS standards beyond those which the board has already made tentative decisions for. Those are the ones listed in paragraph 8. And we've also not identified a need for further application guidance at this time beyond that identified as necessary by the board in November 2018 regarding the application of the model alongside the requirements of IAS 12. In paragraphs 13 through 32, we set out our analysis for four particular areas where we considered but ultimately rejected the need for additional application guidance or amendments to other standards. Those areas were IFRIC 12, IAS 20, IAS 34, and IAS 19. And so that brings us to the question in paragraph 32 on whether board members agree with the staff's conclusion that no further amendments or application guidance are needed at this time.
Okay. Mary?
I agree with your analysis vis-a-vis the standards you identified, with one exception, and then had two potential application guidance issues. The one exception is IS 34. I think the board should be saying that a minimum required line item for the statement of performance is regulatory income and expense, rather than just because the requirement at 34 is categories and subtotals. It isn't individual line items, and I think this is expected to be a significant one. So I think we should specify that. The areas that I not for voting, but I think you should think about whether we need guidance, are some of the interaction with the impairment standard. I'll give it to you offline, but I think there's an issue. If you know that the piece of PP&E that you bought is only going to be used for rate regulated activities, and the regulator, it cost you 120, but the regulator is only going to allow 100. Do you have a known impairment of that, and do you get to ignore it if you argue that the CGU in which it's, grouped would be overall positive. I don't need to work it out today, but I think that's an application guidance question rather than an exception to the standard. The only exception is, I think, an amendment to 34 to require that line item.
And Chao.
Generally, I agree with staff's recommendation. I just have one observation or recommendation. I'm thinking that whether these projects also have some impact on IS7, that is a cash flow statement. First, because we adopted the supplementary model, so whether the cash flow arising from operating activities, we should, you know, require entity to separately disclose those cash flows arising from those price adjustments, those, you know, regulatory activities to be consistent with income statement. I'm not sure, but we need to explore. Secondly, the cash flow may be different. Some cash flow actually relevant to PPE because you have to build PPE. So that is not a cash flow arising from operating activity, maybe relevant to investment activity. But those cash flow maybe should be recovered from future, you know, rate price adjustments, something like relevant to future operating activities. So I would like to encourage explore further whether this project also have some impact on the has in some impact on the IS7.
Sure.
I had read paragraph 27 and assumed that that meant that because if we were requiring separate line items in the income statement under IAS1, that would mean that they would be provided here. And so it did follow, but maybe that was an incorrect reading. Was that what you were thinking?
Yes, but except for the condensed interim financial statements, that's the only one that... For the condensed interim financial statements.
That says shall include at a minimum each of the headings and subtotals that were included in the annual financial statement. So I was assuming that that meant that it would carry across, but Mary's reading headings and subtotals as being a subset and not being all line items.
It says headings, not line items.
I know, which was...
There was an IFRIC interpretation, I think, back in 2014 that raised a similar point that I thought suggested that the individual items came across, but I might be... We would have to recheck.
If that was
it.
The assumption and if that's how it works, then I was basically happy with what you had here. But if the narrower reading is correct, then I think it's such an important item for these guys that we should be making sure it's required. And then I had one question, and sorry, I meant to check this beforehand and I forgot about it. If my memory serves me well, when we did PFS, we decided that to require in the first set of interims that there would be a requirement that the new subtotals be provided because it wouldn't have been in the previous annual. And given that decision, I wondered whether we should have a similar sort of transition requirement, if you like, to make sure that in the first interims these line items were provided in the same way we did in the PFS project. And then if it's the case that after that this other paragraph works, that's fine. Mm-hmm. But I think in the same way we did for PFS, that might make sense here.
Okay. Nick?
So just pick up on what Mary said and then what Sue said. I would agree if it's not clear that it is a minimum line item for under IS34, we should clarify that. I think given the feedback we've had on recent implementation of new standards around interim reporting, again, on transition, it would be helpful that it is there at the first set of interims.
Good. I have in front of me 10 of IS34. And the last sentence of this paragraph says that additional line items or notes shall be included if their omission would make the condensed interim financial statements misleading. So there is a caveat in the provision in that if those balances would be relevant material for. Yeah, it is.
It might want to be more explicit.
It was explicit.
Yeah.
Okay. Yes, Nadeo?
Just one question that I was just whether there is an interaction with IS 38, because it is a right, not necessarily right to receive cash. And then, therefore, it could fall into IS 38. I'm just wondering whether it would be necessary to scope this out of IAS 38 or not. Have we assessed that one?
I think historically it's not been caught by IAS 38, which is why these things weren't being recognised in IFRS financial statements. So I don't think it does meet the definition in the IAS 38.
Isn't IAS 38 also a residual standard, so it applies if something else doesn't? So if the new standard applied, then you'd be outside 38.
There are so many things scoped out of IAS 38. I'm just wondering whether we should add something.
Because this might get circular, because this standard will scope out anything that's already recognised by another standard. So the two would basically say, over to you, and go backwards and forwards. So that may be something we'd need to analyse further, the IAS 38. But I think if it's not clear, then maybe that is just a scope exception that's specific.
So with the suggestions made by the board, can we agree with the staff's recommendation?
14.
And the final paper.
As Mariela mentioned, Agenda Paper 9C recommends the transition requirements for entities that would implement the model. To develop these recommendations, the paper distinguishes between entities that currently apply IFRS standards and first-time adopters. Entities that currently apply IFRS standards include both entities that do not apply IFRS 14 and do not recognize regulatory balances, and entities that recognize regulatory balances and may also apply IFRS 14. We have discussed these two groups of entities separately in the paper, so we'll ask questions on them separately. Entities that currently apply IFRS standards excluding IFRS 14 that do not recognize regulatory balances are discussed in paragraphs 12 through 20. For the reasons set out in paragraph 17, we recommend that these entities should apply the model retrospectively to each prior reporting period presented applying IAS 8, accounting policies, changes in accounting estimates and errors. Does the board agree with the staff's recommendation? Question one is after paragraph 20.
No discussion needed. Dario.
I think I have a problem, an English problem. Date of initial application. As I tell you, that it is used to describe the first day of the annual reporting period. If I'm doing 2020, the first day of an annual reporting period is 1st January.
Depends on your reporting period.
Yeah. And I understood that we are doing this retrospectively. I have the same with the IBOR. I'm just that's chasing me wording. This problem. I have some difficulty to read this.
I have a slide somewhere. It's like date of transition, date of initial application.
Yeah. Look at the glossary. There is no date of initial application in the glossary. Yeah.
I think it's defined in each individual standard where it's used.
Yeah.
Okay. So, considering the requirements that we are proposing for transition, it would be the beginning of the earliest comparative period.
In this example, would be 1st January 2019.
Whatever comparative periods have been presented, even if it is more than 1 year, it will be the beginning of the comparative period, the earliest one.
I think you said that's the date of transition.
Yeah.
Is the beginning of the comparative. The date of adoption.
Yeah.
Would be the beginning of the current year.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So Dale's right. It would be the 1st of January 2020.
I'm glad to hear that.
Problem solved. Do we agree with the staff's recommendation?
13.
Entities that currently apply IFRS standards, possibly including IFRS 14, that do recognize regulatory balances are discussed in paragraphs 21 through 28. For the reasons set out in paragraph 25, we recommend that these entities should also apply the model retrospectively to each prior reporting period presented applying IAS 8. Does the board agree with the staff's recommendations? Question 2 is after paragraph 28.
Fourteen.
Moving on to the section for first-time adopters.
The vote on question one was also 14 as well.
So we leave.
The staff recommend that a first-time adopter applies the model at the date of transition to IFRS standards as defined in IFRS 1 for the reasons set out in paragraphs 30 to 34. Also, for the reasons set out in paragraphs 36 and 37, the staff recommend retaining the deemed cost exemption in paragraph D8B of IFRS 1. Does the board agree with the staff's recommendations? Questions 3 and question 4 are after paragraph 38.
Yes, that is the case.
14.
Moving on to past business combinations, paragraphs 39 to 48 discuss application of the model to business combinations that occurred before the initial application of the model. For the reasons set out in paragraphs 43 to 45, we recommend that entities that currently apply IFRS standards should be permitted to elect not to apply the model retrospectively to past business combinations. This election would relieve entities from revising the purchase price allocations for past business combinations retrospectively, but would still require any balances that exist at transition to be recognized and measured in accordance with the model, thus providing comparable information for each of the reporting periods presented. This approach is consistent with the existing relief in IFRS 1. We can now move on to the questions 5 and 6 that are after paragraph 48. Does the board agree with the staff's recommendation?
Okay, Sue.
Just wanted to ask a clarifying question. Is the proposal here that an entity would make a single election for all of its business combinations as opposed to a combination by combination election?
It will be for all business combinations. It will not be.
Tadeo?
I have one question that's. Suppose, in a certain point in time here, we are saying that we are adjusting the carrying amount of goodwill for any resulting change. What I'm wondering is whether I didn't meet the definition for recognizing the regulatory asset, but someone that has acquired the company did it, and not necessarily has included this within goodwill, might have an asset with the name of concession rights. It is within this number. In this case, would they adjust this concession right? It is not only the regulatory asset inside. There are more. But it's supposed that it's there. Or, in this case, it would be adjusted against goodwill.
So the transition requirements that we are proposing for entities that currently apply IFRS standards would be that they would reclassify any such balances from any different type of an asset into a regulatory asset.
I would identify and then reclassify.
Yes. So in your case, if it is being recognized as a service concession asset, it would be reclassified into a regulatory asset if it meets the definition as per our model. It would not automatically adjust goodwill.
Yan Chao.
Thank you, Hans. I also have a question about recognizing those resulting change to be included in the goodwill. First, I'm not sure, because the goodwill arising from the acquisition transaction, but maybe a couple of years later, because of this transition, and you needed to add back some amount to the carrying amount of the goodwill, whether it really meets the basic principle of goodwill recognition here. First, second, I'll worry about that. If previous year, the last year, and the company already do some, you know, impairment test and recognize impairment loss arising from the goodwill, so that means the carrying amount of the goodwill is not an initial amount. It is consistent with the recovery amount exactly that date. Now you add back some amount to the goodwill. It will not be consistent with the recoverable amount. So if we introduce this notion, I would like to suggest immediately we should require company to do impairment test exactly at that transition date. Otherwise, the goodwill will be overstated because it's not the initial amount. It is not a recoverable amount. It's another amount that simply we edited. There is no meaningful information provided to the users.
Mary?
I have two comments, questions. One is specifically about the BizCom, and one is more generally about transition and number of comparative periods. The one about relief, the wording of the question is that permitted to elect not to apply retrospectively to past business combinations. I think it should apply to any business combinations in the comparative period. And given that you've cited IFRS 1 as the basis for this approach, IFRS 1 requires restatement of business combinations in the comparative period. It doesn't require restatement of BizComs prior to the transition date, which is the beginning of the comparative period. So I wasn't quite sure what you meant when you said not apply retrospectively, if you meant prior to the transition date. But we usually, when we say retrospectively, we're usually talking about from date of adoption. Mm. So that's where my confusion came in. So I think the body language is that you meant not restate business combinations prior to the beginning of the comparative period, yes, rather than the year of adoption.
Yeah, that is great.
Second thing is I didn't understand, this is specifically on BizCom, I didn't understand why we were writing in the complexity of if you restate earlier business combinations, you don't have to restate any business combinations that no longer exist. Because, first of all, I think that could be actually a really painful test because, you know, you bought something that has many operations and you have one employee in the accounting department. Does that business combination still, you know, it just, what do you mean by that business combination doesn't exist? I think you only, if your point is you only restate for I don't get why we introduce a complexity, that complexity. I don't see what problem we were trying to solve with it. I don't remember that extra relief existing in any other standards where we've dealt with business combinations, so I guess I'm questioning why that. Then my last overall comment is, and I'm putting on a U.S. experience hat, which is typically entities reporting that are U.S. SEC registrants are required to provide an additional comparative period, including in some circumstances an opening statement of financial position. And I think I just encourage the staff to think explicitly about that scenario so that at a minimum we are explicit about whether any restatement of comparatives applies to any extra comparative periods presented or not. We've addressed this issue differently in different standards, the revenue standard one way, the insurance standard in another, but I think it's something that, it because it has measurement impacts, needs to be considered explicitly rather than implicitly.
I think on your second point, Mary, it's actually a wording problem. Because I don't think we meant business combinations that still exist. We meant regulatory assets or regulatory liabilities that still exist.
Yes. Yeah.
And so it's saying you don't need to go back and disinter the ones that have vanished by now.
That's where I'd got to, but, yeah. Yeah, the wording is.
Yeah. Okay.
So. And on my first one, are you confirming that restatement retrospective means prior to the comparative period rather than prior to year of adoption?
Yes, so it will be the cutoff will be the date of transition.
Can we vote for question 5?
As clarified.
As clarified, yeah.
14.
6. Mary, you in a mark?
Out. 12.
All right.
You're moving on to the final section of the paper. In some jurisdictions where entities currently recognize regulatory balances, some regulators consider goodwill an allowable cost for inclusion in the rates charged to customers. This paper refers to those balances as goodwill-related regulatory assets. For the reasons set out in paragraphs 55 to 58, we recommend that entities that currently apply IFRS standards and first-time adopters should, on transition to the model, reclassify goodwill-related regulatory assets to goodwill. Does the board agree with the staff's recommendation? Question 7 and 8 are after paragraph 63.
I still have similar concern about the goodwill. Yeah, so the reason is same as the previous one.
Can we vote for questions 7 and 8 at once?
11.
Okay. That brings us to the end of this discussion and also to the moment that we memorized that this is the last meeting that Jane is at the table.
Indeed.
You have been with us for 7 years. You did a whole lot of stuff. You worked on polluting pricing, pollution pricing mechanisms. You were the chief liaison for the IASB. You helped setting up the research program to set up the new website. And, of course, you devoted a whole lot of time to this project, rate regulation, which is near the finish line, but you have reached the finish line before the project. You are going to retire now and spend a lot of time on your favorite pastimes, which is cricket. And, well, we thank you for all your hard work for the ISB, and we wish you, of course, all the best in your retirement.
Thank you. Can I just point out I am not old enough to retire? I'm just very no kids, no mortgage.
Okay, well,
I'm just
enjoy.
Gonna have fun.
All right.
Thank you, Hans.
Okay. Management commentary.